Chapter 4. The Resistance Movement. Nature of the Resistance Movement. Chapter 2 noted that Hezbollah was founded on a belief in Islamic universalism guided by Velayat-e Faqih, and was also committed to the goals of representing the interests of the Shia community along with fighting Zionism and what it regarded as oppression. These goals and others were announced to the world in 1985 with the organization's open letter, addressed to the downtrodden in Lebanon and in the world. Before this time, the organization itself could at best be characterized as a loose collection of like-minded individuals with a similar set of goals. Regarding Velayat-e Faqih, the open letter is quite clear, stating, "We obey the orders of one leader, wise and just, that of our tutor and faqih, jurist, who fulfills all the necessary conditions, Ruhollah Mousawi Khomeini. God save him. Our behavior is dictated to us by legal principles laid down by the light of an overall political conception defined by the leading jurist, Velayat-e al-Faqih. And when it becomes necessary to carry out the holy war, each of us takes up his assignment in the fight in accordance with the injunctions of the law, and that in the framework of the mission carried out under the tutelage of the commanding jurist." The open letter is also quite clear regarding the source of inspiration for the group. "As for our culture, it is based on the Holy Quran, the Sunnah, and the legal rulings of the faqih, who is our source of imitation, Marja al-Taqlid. Our culture is crystal clear, it is not complicated, and is accessible to all." Chapter 2 discussed in detail the intellectual milieu that contributed to the emergence of dynamic Shiism in the 1960s and 1970s, and as is to be expected, given the timing of the emergence of the group, upon its founding, Hezbollah accepted Khomeini's notion of functional velayat, where in the age of occultation, the velayat represents God's testimony. Hence, as God's act of revelation to the infallible prophet and the imams endowed them with velayat over the ummah, in their absence, this authority is delegated to the Velayat-e Faqih, with the implication that, quote, "anybody who disobeys him or the jurists disobeys God," close quote. Additionally, for Hezbollah, the necessity of establishing an Islamic order was made apparent by God's revelations to the prophet Muhammad and his rightful heirs, the Shia imams, who were called on to guide the Muslims in constructing a just Islamic society. Interestingly, however, the open letter betrayed a tension between the desire for an Islamic state and self-determination on the part of the Lebanese people, as it stated, "Let us put it truthfully. The sons of Hezbollah know who are their major enemies in the Middle East: the Falanges, Israel, France, and the U.S. The sons of our ummah are now in a state of growing confrontation with them, and will remain so until the realization of the following three objectives: A. To expel the Americans, the French, and their allies definitely from Lebanon, putting an end to any colonialist entity on our land. B. To submit the Falanges to a just power, and bring them all to justice for the crimes they have perpetrated against Muslims and Christians. C. To permit all the sons of our people to determine their future and to choose in all the liberty the form of government they desire. We call upon all of them to pick the option of Islamic government, which alone is capable of guaranteeing justice and liberty for all. Only an Islamic regime can stop any further tentative attempts of imperialistic infiltration into our country." Hence, in addition to serving as a moral and religious imperative, an Islamic government for Hezbollah served an instrumental purpose, as it represented the ideal form of social and political organization for combating what it regarded as imperialism. In this regard, various countries were singled out for special attention, as the preceding quote attests, especially the United States. The U.S. has tried, through its local agents, to persuade the people that those who crushed their arrogance in Lebanon and frustrated their conspiracy against the oppressed, Mustarafin, were nothing but a bunch of fanatic terrorists whose sole aim is to dynamite bars and destroy slot machines. Such suggestions cannot and will not mislead our ummah, for the whole world knows that whoever wishes to oppose the U.S., that arrogant superpower, cannot indulge in marginal acts which may make it deviate from its major objective. We combat abomination, and we shall tear out its very roots, its primary roots, which are the U.S. All attempts made to drive us into marginal actions will fail, especially as our determination to fight the U.S. is solid. We declare openly and loudly that we are an ummah which fears God only, and is by no means ready to tolerate injustice, aggression, and humiliation. America, its Atlantic Pact allies, and the Zionist entity in the Holy Land of Palestine attacked us and continue to do so without respite. Their aim is to make us eat dust continually. This is why we are, more and more, in a state of permanent alert in order to repel aggression and defend our religion, our existence, our dignity. They invaded our country, destroyed our villages, slit the throats of our children, violated our sanctuaries, and appointed masters over our people who committed the worst massacres against our ummah. They do not cease to give support to these allies of Israel, and do not enable us to decide our future according to our own wishes. Norton noted that France was singled out for its support of the Maronite community and for arms sales to Iraq. Israel, of course, was also the target for invective, as the group refused to acknowledge the legitimacy of the Jewish state and rejected all forms of negotiations with it. A section of the open letter titled, "The Necessity for the Destruction of Israel," stated, "We see in Israel the vanguard of the United States in our Islamic world. It is the hated enemy that must be fought until the hated ones get what they deserve. This enemy is the greatest danger to our future generations and to the destiny of our lands, particularly as it glorifies the ideas of settlement and expansion initiated in Palestine and yearning outward to the extension of the great Israel from the Euphrates to the Nile. Our primary assumption in our fight against Israel states that the Zionist entity is aggressive from its inception and built on lands wrested from their owners at the expense of the rights of the Muslim people. Therefore, our struggle will end only when this entity is obliterated. We recognize no treaty with it, no ceasefire, and no peace agreements, whether separate or consolidated. We vigorously condemn all plans for negotiation with Israel and regard all negotiators as enemies, for the reason that such negotiation is nothing but the recognition of the legitimacy of the Zionist occupation of Palestine. Therefore, we oppose and reject the Camp David agreements, the proposals of King Fahd, the Fez and Reagan plan, Brezhnev's and the French-Egyptian proposals, and all other programs that include the recognition, even the implied recognition, of the Zionist entity." 24 years passed before Hezbollah released an update. The 2009 manifesto was developed during the 7th political conference of the group and announced during a press conference in Beirut in November 2009. The group still called for the destruction of Israel and the removal of Western influence from the Islamic world. But in other respects, there are notable contrasts with the 1985 open letter. Most importantly, the group dropped its calls for the establishment of an Islamic state in Lebanon. Specifically, the 2009 manifesto calls for the creation of a, quote, "political system that truly represents the will of the people and their aspirations for justice, freedom, security, stability, well-being, and dignity," close quote. In the 1980s, the group regarded the Lebanese political system as clientelistic and irredeemably corrupt, and while the middle-class members of Amal sought to ingratiate themselves within the system, Hezbollah sought its overthrow and replacement with an ideal form Islamic government. Gleiss and Berti argued that this shift reflected a level of pragmatism, as the group realized that an Islamic form of government grounded in Veliyat-e Faqih was simply not realistic in Lebanon's multi-confessional society. Additionally, the authors argued that this shift reflected perhaps a recognition by Hezbollah that it had a stake in Lebanon's political system, as the group had been participating in elections since the early 1990s and, as a result, had acquired significant political clout. Lastly, the group also paid homage to Syria and Iran. It praised Syria's role for leading the resistance against Israel and the group reaffirmed the importance of the relationship with Iran, stating, "Hezbollah considers Iran as a central state in the Islamic world, since it is the state that dropped, through its revolution, the Shah's regime and its American-Israeli projects. It's also the state that supported the resistance movements in our region and stood with courage and determination at the side of the Arab and Islamic causes, on top of which is the Palestinian cause." The group also toned down its Islamic universalism, as it dropped its call for the establishment of a pan-Islamic state that was to begin with the export of the revolution to Lebanon. It stated, "What we call for today is not emerging unity in the Arab or Islamic world. We rather call for the unity between Arab and Islamic states, which guards these states' and nations' specifications and sovereignty." Strategies and supporting narratives. The differences between the 1985 open letter and the 2009 manifesto reflect Hezbollah's changing strategy, as well as important continuities in the intervening period. After the Taif Agreement, Hezbollah no longer sought to replace the Lebanese political system with an Islamic state, and on the battlefield, it focused on the Israeli enemy. Consequently, it largely adopted irregular techniques in place of terrorist tactics. An interesting perspective through which to analyze the changes and continuities of its strategy is by analyzing the discourse espoused by the group, and social movement theory, SMT, is one tool through which to analyze the group's narrative. SMT, and in particular, the subfield of SMT that emphasizes the notion of a frame and the social construction of meaning and reality, offers a useful paradigm to deconstruct insurgent narratives and understand how they promote collective action. Developed by sociologists to understand the formation and evolution of a variety of social movements, such as, for example, the white separatist movement in the United States, the environmental movement, the civil rights movement, and the anti-abortion movement, among others, the concepts developed by social movement theorists can also be fruitfully applied to study various insurgent movements, which can also be seen as social movements. A fundamental concept within SMT is that of a frame. Goffman defined frames as schemata of interpretation that enable people to locate, perceive, identify, and label events that they experience or become aware of. More simply, a frame represents a worldview or paradigm through which events and concepts are interpreted, and as such, it represents a means through which meaning is constructed and reality is interpreted. Within the context of a social movement or an insurgency, by assigning motives and meanings, a frame can help promote collective action. Leaders of social movements can do this by developing what Benford and Snow label as a collective action frame, which consists of, quote, action-oriented sets of beliefs and meanings that inspire and legitimate the activities and campaigns of a social movement organization, close quote. Thus, collective action frames perform an interpretive function by simplifying and condensing the world out there, especially in ways, quote, intended to mobilize potential adherents and constituents, to garner bystander support, and to demobilize antagonists, close quote. A key aspect of a collective action frame is that it is, quote, not merely aggregations of individual attitudes and perceptions, but also the outcome of negotiating shared meanings, close quote, such as, say, through narratives, writings, and the exchange of ideas among a community of people. Benford and Snow noted that collective action frames perform three core framing tasks, specifically diagnostic framing, prognostic framing, and motivational framing. The first involves problem and victim identification and the attribution of responsible actors and causes of the problem. The second entails the specification of a proposed solution and a strategy for carrying out corrective action. Motivational framing provides a rationale for engaging in remedial collective action, including an appropriate vocabulary of motive. Each of these concepts can be fruitfully applied to an analysis of the evolution of Hezbollah's narrative over time. Karagiannis noted that in the 1980s, Hezbollah's diagnostic frame centered around an injustice frame, in which Lebanon's ills were blamed on the Israeli occupation and on what it regarded as a sectarian and illegitimate political system. The 1985 open letter noted that, quote, "The present regime is the product of an arrogance so unjust that no reform or modification can remedy it. It should be changed radically." Close quote. However, Kargiannis noted that after the acceptance of the TIFE agreement, the group's diagnostic frame changed from an injustice frame to an unfairness frame. That is, once Hezbollah set aside the goal of overthrowing the political system and indeed began to participate in politics, it began to emphasize the unfairness and sectarianism of the Lebanese political system. For instance, its election program from 1992 noted, "It is now imperative to cooperate with other devoted parties in order to complete the necessary steps towards the forging of internal peace on the basis of political concord that is furthest as could be from abominable sectarian biases or narrow confessional discriminations." Additionally, the group's election program from 1996 emphasized, quote, "the unbalanced nature of the Lebanese political system and the wrong practices by the government led to the deepening of corruption, favoritism, besides establishing the sectarian, confessional, and regional divisions," close quote. Of course, there are also notable continuities in Hezbollah's narrative, despite its change in domestic strategy, as the 2009 manifesto also identified Israel as a problem that needed to be eliminated. A prognostic frame specifies a proposed solution and a strategy for implementing the latter. As has been noted, in its early years, Hezbollah's prognostic frame centered on establishing an Iranian-style Islamic government in Lebanon. As Nasrallah once stated, "We do not believe in multiple Islamic republics. We do believe, however, in a single Islamic world governed by a central government, because we consider all borders throughout the Muslim world as fake and colonialist, and therefore doomed to disappear. We do not believe in a nation whose borders are 10,452 square kilometers in Lebanon. Our project foresees Lebanon as part of the political map of an Islamic world in which specificities would cease to exist, but in which the rights, freedom, and dignities of minorities within it are guaranteed." Yet after the TIFE Accords, Hezbollah's prognostic frame became more geographically bounded and territorialized, as the group focused on improving conditions in Lebanon. Its 1996 electoral program noted, "Achieving justice and equality among the Lebanese is considered one of the main bases for establishing a dignified and prosperous country, in which all the Lebanese engage in the process of construction with drive and solidarity under equality of opportunities, equality for all, individuals, classes, and areas, in rights and duties, whether political, economical, or social." Hence, rather than adhering to a prognostic frame centered on the motto, "Islam is the answer," the group adopted a frame that Kargiannis described as a prognostic frame of representative governance, which emphasized the establishment of a pluralistic political system in which some notion of justice and fairness prevailed. Lastly, despite the evolution of Hezbollah, there is continuity to its motivational frame, which, as is the case with all social movements, is intended to encourage and incentivize actual participation. Kargiannis noted that the group heavily used Shia religious symbols and narratives to encourage participation in the movement. One such strategy involved equating the sacrifices made by Hezbollah leaders with those of canonical Shia imams. For instance, after the assassination by Israel of Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi, Hezbollah's secretary general at the time, Nasrallah noted that his death, quote, "epitomized the events at Karbala," close quote, and that Musawi, quote, "was just like al-Hussein, a body without a head, just like al-Abbas, with his hands severed, and just like the greatest, Ali, with his torn flesh," close quote. Additionally, Kargiannis also noted that the group has consistently adopted a Jerusalem liberation frame, in which the group framed its military actions against Israel as a religious duty for devout Muslims to liberate Palestine and Jerusalem from infidels. Jerusalem, as the location where Muslims believe the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven, typically received special mention. On one occasion, Nasrallah noted that, quote, "Jerusalem is the land of Allah. It constitutes an Islamic cultural dimension not subject to negotiation or compromise." Close quote. Additionally, a slogan adopted by the group was "Kadimun Yakuts," "We are coming, Jerusalem." On other occasions, the group's motivational frame de-emphasized religion and instead grounded its resistance against Israel on pan-Arabism and nationalism, with an emphasis on liberating Arab territory from Israel and protecting Lebanon's independence. For instance, after the Israeli release of a long-held Lebanese prisoner, Nasrallah linked Hezbollah's struggle against Israel with the struggles of Palestinian groups by noting that "the resistance movements in the region, and particularly in Lebanon and Palestine, are complementary continuous movements with accumulating efforts, experiences, and sacrifices so that they might accomplish the same objectives in liberating the land, people, and sacred places." On another occasion, Nasrallah painted the group as a defender of Lebanon's independence and territorial integrity, noting that, quote, "Hezbollah, along with its friends and allies, is the first defender of genuine sovereignty, genuine independence, and genuine freedom, and I add to them national dignity, honor, and pride." Close quote. Hence, the group's motivational frame was flexible enough to appeal to various audiences, whether devout Shias motivated by liberating Jerusalem, secular and Sunni Arabs nursing grievances against Israel, and Lebanese keen on maintaining the country's independence, at least with respect to Israel. Structure and dynamics of the resistance movement. Leadership. Hezbollah is headed by a 9-member Shura Council, one member of which is elected as the Secretary General. 7 members are Lebanese, while 2 members are Iranian, specifically from the embassies in Beirut and Damascus. Members are elected to the council for 3-year terms by the Central Council, an assembly of almost 200 party founders and cadres. Because the members of the Central Council are not necessarily representative of the rank and file of the party, Hezbollah does not resemble most Western political parties, but instead is similar in structure to the Iranian political system, in which the Assembly of Experts elects the Council of Guardians. The members of the Shura Council have mostly been clerics, although there have also been laypersons with needed skills, such as in health, social affairs, finance, and information technology, on the council. They must, however, demonstrate faith in Islam and belief in Veliyat-e Faqih before being considered for leadership positions. The original Shura Council had only 1 member who was not a cleric. However, after the Taif Accords, there was an increase in laity on the council, with the number of non-clerics increasing to 3 members. This was reversed after 2001, among concerns that Hezbollah was straying from its core principles, and the council at that time again shifted back to only 1 non-cleric. The Shura Council elects the Secretary General and his deputies, and the chairman of the 5 councils that constitute the executive administrative apparatus. The Shura Council is a highly homogeneous group and primarily works by consensus, with members finding mutually beneficial arrangements and appointing each other's preferred candidates to important posts. The Shura Council is in charge of overall administration, planning, and policymaking. Rulings by the council are considered to be religiously binding on party members. When disagreements arise within the council, the Wali al-Faqih, jurisconsult, can be called on to make a ruling that is binding on the council. The Wali al-Faqih at the founding of Hezbollah was Ayatollah Khomeini, and is currently Khomeini's successor as supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. Although there is no formal rule that Hezbollah is tied to the supreme leader of Iran, and in theory Hezbollah could select another religious leader as its Wali al-Faqih, in practice, the financial and operational ties between Iran and Hezbollah make it likely that this connection will continue into the future. The Secretary General at present is Syed Hassan Nasrallah, who has held the post since 1992, when Syed Abbas al-Musawi was assassinated by Israel. The Secretary General is supposed to be limited to only 2 terms. However, Ayatollah Khamenei issued a religious ruling that Nasrallah may continue beyond this limit, and the Shura Council has continued to elect him every 3 years. While technically subordinate to the Shura Council, Nasrallah has a strong personal following and enjoys substantial political support from Iran. The death of his son in 2000 in fighting with Israeli troops increased Nasrallah's support among Hezbollah's membership and was seen as a personal sacrifice for the movement. Organizational structure. The operations of Hezbollah are split between the executive administrative apparatus and the military and security apparatus. Both organizations are controlled by the Shura Council and Secretary General, but operate separately. The executive administrative apparatus consists of five councils, each headed by one of the members of the Shura Council. The Executive Council runs programs in education, health, information, construction, finance, and external relations, and also handles some security issues. The Politburo operates as an advisory council to the Shura Council. The Parliamentary Council is tasked with issues regarding Hezbollah members of parliament and involvement of Hezbollah in the Lebanese political system. The Judicial Council functions as Hezbollah's internal judicial system. During the chaos of the civil war, the Judicial Council handled all manner of legal issues in Hezbollah areas, but with the growth of the Lebanese state, some functions have been transferred to the national courts, although the Judicial Council continues to handle internal matters. The Jihad Council analyzes the enemy and identifies the appropriate means to use against it. These means can include martyrdom operations and fighting, but also unarmed methods. For the Jihad Council to advocate the use of violence requires approval by the Wali Afaqih. Although the Jihad Council decides on the strategies and tactics of jihad, implementation is left to the military and security apparatus, whose exact structure is harder to identify and has proven difficult to penetrate. The apparatus is technically under the direct control of the Shura Council, but in reality is under the personal control of the Secretary General. It is divided into the Islamic Resistance and the Security Organ. The Islamic Resistance is the military wing of the party and is divided into two sections, the Enforcement and Recruitment Section and the Combat Section. Enforcement and recruitment provides religious indoctrination and reinforces belief in Wilayat al-Faqih, while the Combat Section provides martial training. The outcome of training determines which combat role a recruit will fill. The Combat Section is divided into four organs or units, with the first unit consisting of martyrs, who carry out extremely dangerous missions, including but not limited to suicide missions. The second unit consists of commandos or special forces, who represent personnel who have excelled in guerrilla warfare. The third unit consists of rocket launchers and other weapons specialists. And the final unit consists of the regular fighters, who are trained for combat but whose primary responsibility is surveillance, logistics, and medical support. Hezbollah's military command structure is divided by region and then by sector. It is highly compartmentalized to reduce the risk that individuals who are captured or otherwise compromised will be able to give away information about the whole organization. Although there are clearly operational connections between Hezbollah and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, the degree of cooperation is unclear. There are reports that the members of the IRGC work in Hezbollah's operational headquarters. The other branch of the military and security apparatus is the Security Organ. It is divided into two sections, the first known as Party Security and the second as External Security. Party Security is tasked with preventing enemies from penetrating the party, and it keeps files on all party members and all people who approach the party. Hezbollah members are required to report meetings, contacts, and relations with all individuals and groups. Reportedly, Israel and the United States have made many attempts to penetrate Hezbollah, heightening awareness among party security and general membership of the intelligence threat. The primary function of external security is counterintelligence, to prevent the organization's enemies in Lebanon and abroad from penetrating the organization. This division may have cells in a number of Western countries and potential connections to Iranian intelligence, although little is known about the exact structure and capabilities of the external security branch. The membership of Hezbollah is estimated to be more than 200,000. The vast majority of the membership is Shiite, although members of other Lebanese sects are allowed to join, and some do. Hezbollah is the largest of all Lebanese political parties, although the party is controlled by a cadre of elites, the Central Council, which makes leadership decisions. The membership of the party does not have any direct influence on leadership decisions. Financing for Hezbollah comes from a few wealthy donors and from Iran, not from members, further reducing Hezbollah's reliance on its members. Hezbollah is highly selective in whom it recruits as members. After the inception of the organization in 1982, Hezbollah relied on mass mobilization of members along family and clan lines, depending on personal connections to maintain operational security. Given the political situation after the Israeli invasion, finding sufficient numbers of recruits was not a problem. Today, the situation has changed, and the addition of new members relies on a formal process of recruitment. Hezbollah is able to be discerning in whom it allows into the organization and has multidimensional criteria for recruits, including religious observance, hostility toward Israel, and dedication to promoting justice and dignity for the Shia community. The process of identifying potential members starts with recruiters in Shia villages and neighborhoods throughout the country. Hezbollah runs schools, summer camps, and scouting groups, and also organizes soccer leagues and other events for young Lebanese in order to develop interest in the organization, as well as to give recruiters a means of identifying prospective future members. Some basic training and familiarization with the concepts of guerrilla warfare occurs at young ages, but the formal recruitment process does not start until recruits are at least 18 years old. Recruiters look for young men who are pious, disciplined, modest, intelligent, healthy, and well-behaved. Traits seen as moral flaws, such as listening to music, drinking alcohol, driving fast cars, and flirting with girls, disqualify young men from being recruited. After being selected as a possible recruit, the process of joining Hezbollah usually takes 2 years. The first year is called Tadarat, meaning reinforcement or preparation. It consists of training on Hezbollah's ideology and culture. Recruits must accept the leadership of the party and accept the party's religious views. Many recruits decide during this year that they are not willing to accept the requirements and discipline that the party demands and drop out of the process, while others are considered unfit by the organization and are not asked to continue. The reinforcement process is supposed to strengthen the positive moral traits for which the recruits were originally identified. Recruits live in an atmosphere of religion and faithfulness, with the purpose of making them love Hezbollah and fully accept the group's ideology. During this first year, prospective members do not receive any military training and do not even see a gun. The second year of the process is called intizam, meaning ordered discipline or commitment. During this part of the process, the recruits are taught discipline, as well as physical fitness and military training. It is during this stage that the recruit's role in the party is determined. This role could be in the military, political, or social branches of the party. Despite the rigors of the indoctrination process, self-reliance and autonomy are encouraged, and members' personal religious views help to determine which roles they play in the organization. Members are allowed to decide for themselves whether they are willing to volunteer for martyrdom missions. Members are expected to progress individually through a process known as the Greater Jihad, consisting of developing a personal religious connection with God. This is contrasted with the Lesser Jihad, which includes military conflict. Although the military jihad is the more visible aspect of Hezbollah from an outsider's perspective, the rigors of the internal religious aspects of the organization are more challenging for many members. During the 1980s and 1990s, Hezbollah ran training camps in the anti-Lebanon mountains near the border with Syria. The camps were in fixed positions, but were assumed to be safe, both because of their position far from Israel and because they were covered by Syrian air defenses. In 1994, however, the Israeli Air Force attacked one of the camps, killing 40 recruits in a nighttime raid. This attack precipitated the bombing of the Asociación Mutual Israelita Argentina, AMIA, 6 weeks later, killing 85 people. Since the Israeli attack on its training facilities, Hezbollah has avoided fixed locations. even the recruits are not told where they are going. They are loaded into vans with covered windows and driven long distances with multiple switchbacks to ensure the location of the training sites remains secret. The training process involves hauling rocks and heavy equipment up mountainsides while instructors launch surprise ambushes on the recruits, complete with explosives and live ammunition to teach the recruits to operate under fire. Physical deprivations include hiking without shoes and sleeping in the open without blankets. Members are allowed one canteen of water per day for drinking as well as washing before prayers. Recruits are taught how to use AK-47s, rocket-propelled grenades, mines, and other explosives. Some individuals are given advanced training with other weapons. Everyone receives training with communications equipment, and special emphasis is placed on navigation, surveillance, and avoiding detection. Some members are selected for more advanced training in Iran, under the supervision of Hezbollah trainers at IRGC facilities. Acceptance into the party is contingent on passing a security review by party security. Some members with specialized and needed skills can skip the reinforcement and order discipline stages, but all members are required to pass the security review. Any potential member who has lived overseas, as many Lebanese have, receives extra scrutiny. Areas where Hezbollah operates are patrolled by internal security officers who observe members' activities and keep track of any foreigners and other outsiders who are in the area. Members usually receive little or no pay for the first 2 or 3 years in Hezbollah. As they progress through the organization, there is limited pay. However, the organization provides support for housing, education, and other needs. The strict moral code that members are required to follow prevents them from accepting money or other gifts. Although the financial benefits are limited, members know that their needs will be taken care of, and that if they die, their families will be provided for. Hezbollah, as a particularistic party that represents Shia interests, recognizes that it cannot represent all of Lebanon or all of the Islamic community, and as such has created what it calls the Islamic Current to improve cooperation with other groups that share similar interests and goals. These groups include other Shia groups, such as Islamic Amal and Faithful Resistance, as well as non-Shia groups including Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hamas, and the Islamic Association of Lebanon. An additional form of outreach is conducted through what are known as umbrella groups, which cooperate with Hezbollah but to a lesser degree than Islamic Current groups. These include the Assembly of Muslim Clergy, an organization of Sunni and Shiite clerics working to bridge differences within the Islamic community, and the Lebanese Resistance Brigades, an organization formed by Hezbollah and consisting of Islamists and non-Islamists who come together to fight Israel. The Lebanese Resistance Brigades can be used by Hezbollah to bring more fighters under its command without posing an internal security threat, because these fighters are kept separate from the Islamic Resistance. Command, control, communications, and computers. Hezbollah's media outlets rank among the largest information network of any regional political party and include the satellite channel Al-Manar, The Beacon, with more than 10 million viewers, as well as 4 licensed radio stations and 5 licensed newspapers, all of which garnered substantial receipts through advertising sales. Al-Manar, available throughout the Arab world via satellite, has a corporate atmosphere with state-of-the-art editing and production equipment, as well as a team of foreign correspondents located throughout the Middle East, Europe, and North America. Unlike much of the Western media, which has abided by a taboo on depicting grisly images of the dead and wounded, Al-Manar has openly shown such images, although it is worth noting that many other regional media outlets have done so as well. Such material has routinely included maimed and dead children, disembodied limbs, and even live feeds during the 2006 war of civilians being shelled during Israeli air raids. Al-Manar's pioneering use of footage from actual battles with Israeli soldiers has been widely credited with helping to reverse regional feelings of impotence in the struggle with Israel. The channel also targeted Israeli audiences with psychological operations aimed at demoralizing the public, messages were based on Hezbollah's understanding that Israeli society was incapable of and unwilling to absorb large casualties because of its tightly knit social fabric. The use of Google Maps technology in 2006 allowed the station to pinpoint particular locales in northern Israel to target, creating substantial anxiety for residents. In addition, the station also launched the Who's Next campaign, which displayed a continuously updated photo gallery of the latest Israel Defense Forces, IDF, casualties, followed by the image of a question mark superimposed over an empty silhouette. Its post-2006 investment in longer-range antennae allowed the station to send its signal as far as Haifa, Israel's third-largest city. In addition to targeting parties directly involved in the conflict, Hezbollah also crafted messages for parties that had influence over regional conflicts, including the United States and neighboring Arab countries. Finally, cyberspace has also become an important arena for Hezbollah's communication strategy. The organization's technicians have routinely hijacked servers and websites to transmit their own information, while also ensuring that ordinary traffic was not disrupted and that their hijacking activities remained unnoticed. In addition to using the web to transmit information among group members, Hezbollah has used it to send information to the media. Because Hezbollah has an extensive presence on the web and the information available on its websites appears credible, the information has been used by Israeli journalists and other correspondents covering the region. When several Israeli teenagers launched a cyber attack on a number of Hezbollah sites, as well as those of Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, in 2000, the response was intense. Hackers struck the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and an IDF site, and later also targeted the Israeli Prime Minister's office, the Bank of Israel, and the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange. Hezbollah's battlefield communications network was crucial to the group's military successes in the 2006 war with Israel. Official reports indicate that the group was successful in rebuffing Israeli efforts to jam its communication systems south of the Litani River. Jamming signals are restricted in range to relatively small areas. In addition, reports suggest that the group may have possessed the capability to disrupt some Israeli communications. Despite a relatively high level of technological sophistication, Hezbollah used landlines, primarily copper cable, which is highly susceptible to jamming and tapping. Most of these lines were merely laid next to existing utility lines, both public and private, enabling the group to use existing infrastructure and link far-flung outposts and offices. Yet the vulnerability of these lines meant that the organization did not rely on them, except as a secondary or emergency method of communication. Increasingly, the group has replaced older copper cable wiring with fiber optic lines to serve its headquarters, television and radio stations, military compounds, and mobile rocket launching facilities, because fiber optic material is immune to many of the deficiencies of copper wiring. Mobile communications technology, primarily cell phones, which are inexpensive, portable, and lightweight, but also satellite phones, is the group's most common method of communication. During the 2006 conflict, Hezbollah used an elaborate system of radio call signs and a closed cellular phone system. The latter was designed to handle short message service and email as the primary formats of information exchange. Because jammers could disrupt the flow of signals only in a small area and were also limited by mountainous terrain, the Lebanese theater being both large and mountainous, Hezbollah operatives were largely able to evade Israel's efforts, which were concentrated in a few high-value areas to deny the flow of communication. Hezbollah's Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah underscored the centrality of the group's communication network in 2008, when, as the Western-backed Lebanese government declared the organization's media assets both illegal and an attack on Lebanese sovereignty, he declared these assets to be the group's single most important weapon and stated that any disruption to the network perpetrated by government authorities would be an act of war. Resources and external support. Hezbollah has been able to draw on a wide range of financial sources, including funding from Iran, sympathetic donors in Arab countries, and the group's own extensive business interests, both licit and illicit. The group has also raised funds in Africa by taking advantage of the large expatriate Lebanese community on the continent. Levitt noted that most of the funds raised in Africa come from, quote, expatriate donations, mafia-style shakedowns, front companies, and even blood diamonds and drugs, close quote. Israeli officials have identified the Ivory Coast and Senegal as important centers of fundraising activity on the continent, and the group is suspected of profiting from the trade in blood diamonds originating from Angola, Sierra Leone, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Additionally, the sizable Lebanese expatriate community in South America has made the region, in addition to Africa, a hub for generating finance. And in 2008, a drug probe found that the Lebanese operator of an enormous cocaine money laundering operation in Colombia donated a portion of his proceeds to Hezbollah. Estimates of Iranian resources flowing to Hezbollah range from a low of $100 million per year to a high of $350 million. Other forms of Iranian assistance have included hardware, training provided for military and resistance activities, the services of Iranian engineers, doctors, and other professionals, and financial services designed to help the group evade international sanctions. However, most of these funds come from private foundations and charitable organizations in Iran or from the IRGC. Financing from Arab donors to Hezbollah was primarily in the form of tithes, the portion of income that believers are required to donate to charitable causes under Shiite religious law, as well as donations from individuals, groups, small businesses, and banks in the Arab world and among the Shiite international community. Hezbollah also received significant income from the group's domestic business chains, which include supermarkets, gas stations, department stores, restaurants, construction companies, and travel agencies, as well as offshore companies, banks, and currency exchanges. Most of this money was held in Tehrani banks to prevent seizure of the group's assets. These Iranian institutions also operated under the legal strictures of Islamic finance, which provided added religious legitimacy. In addition, several Lebanese financial institutions acted as intermediaries between Hezbollah and mainstream banks, facilitated by extremely lax transparency and oversight of the financial sector. During the 2006 war, Israel bombed as many as 12 banks, including two large ones, Al Baraka and Franza Bank, as well as the home of a bank manager. Political activities. At the end of the civil war, Hezbollah made a decision to become involved in the Lebanese political system. The decision to make the transition from a militant group to a political party was contentious within the leadership. Hezbollah's originally stated purpose was to support the creation of an Islamic state, and while some leaders and clerics advocated involvement in politics as a means of promoting this goal, others felt that involvement in a secular government was profane and therefore illegitimate for an Islamic organization. Sheikh Mohammed Hussein Fadlallah, revered by many Hezbollah members although not formally part of the group, supported involvement, swaying the opinion of many in Hezbollah. The final decision to become involved was made by Ayatollah Ali Khomeini in his capacity as Hezbollah's Wali Faqih. Hezbollah candidates ran in the 1992 Lebanese election. Since then, Hezbollah has continued to win about 10% of the seats in the National Assembly. Although religious issues play a part in Hezbollah's appeal to voters, the organization also appeals to voters using secular messages. The history of poverty and disenfranchisement of the Shia community has made appeals for justice and development powerful electoral issues for Hezbollah. Hezbollah has also made use of practical electoral alliances with groups of different ideologies, at times working with Maronite and communist groups that it fought bitterly against during the Civil War. In municipal elections, Hezbollah competes with Amal for support in Shia areas. Hezbollah has done well in the southern suburbs of Beirut, but in South Lebanon and Bekaa, competition between Hezbollah and Amal has been intense, showing that although it is popular, Hezbollah does not have the unconditional support of the Shia community. Further evidence that Hezbollah has to respond to the desires of the voters rather than dictate policy to its supporters was the establishment of the Revolution of the Hungry, a breakaway faction started by Subi al-Tufayli, a former Secretary General of Hezbollah who left the party and ran a separate slate of candidates to protest a perceived lack of assistance from Hezbollah for its most needy constituents. Al-Tufayli won several seats in 1998, prompting Hezbollah to adopt more populist policies to regain the support of the poorest of its constituents. Before 2005, Hezbollah's political participation at the national level was restricted to parliament, as the group demurred from joining an executive cabinet over concerns that doing so would diminish its credentials as an opposition movement and signal its acceptance of Lebanon's confessional system. However, Gleiss and Berti noted that the group eventually joined the cabinet in Fouad Senyora's government over concerns that Syria's control over Lebanon was slipping away in the wake of international condemnation over Syria's suspected role in the 2005 assassination of Rafik Hariri, which led Hezbollah to fear that its political enemies would seek the disarmament of the group. The group would soon constitute one of the key partners in a political formation known as the March 8 Alliance, whose name derives from the date in 2005 of a pro-Syria rally held in Beirut. The coalition ruled Lebanon from June 2011 until March 2013. Interestingly, the group shared power with other powerful coalition members who did not necessarily share Hezbollah's political, economic, or religious agendas. Hezbollah's Christian ally, Michael Aoun, leader of the Free Patriotic Movement, failed to fully split the vote of his co-religionists in the June 2009 election, as many Christians remained with the opposing March 14 alliance. This failure prevented Hezbollah from expanding on previous electoral gains, as the support of the Shia population alone could not propel Hezbollah to a parliamentary majority. A second factor preventing Hezbollah from gaining full control of the government is the electoral rules regarding the allotment of both parliamentary seats and cabinet positions. The result of these rules has been an intensely divided government, often paralyzed by gridlock. This division came to a head in November 2006 when Hezbollah and its allies left their cabinet posts in protest over the efforts by the March 14-led government to establish an international tribunal to investigate the assassination of Hariri, and the departure of the opposition members of the cabinet morphed into a long-running boycott that paralyzed the central government. In May 2008, this standoff escalated into armed confrontation, as the government sought to shut down Hezbollah's communication network, which was operated separately from the rest of the country. This latest outburst of violence featured confrontations among different sectarian groups and saw Hezbollah deploy gunmen to seize areas of West Beirut. More recently, Hezbollah repeated the tactic of resigning from the government in January 2011, this time causing the collapse of the government of Saad Hariri, Rafik's son, over disagreements with the March 14-led government regarding Lebanon's cooperation with the United Nations Special Tribunal for Lebanon. This tribunal, which was responsible for investigating Rafik's assassination, was rumored to be on the verge of issuing indictments against members of Hezbollah. Methods of warfare. The majority of Hezbollah's military activities centered on its guerrilla campaign against the IDF in southern Lebanon, 1982 to 2000. The campaign focused on low-intensity attacks targeting a small number of IDF soldiers. Although it was not overwhelmingly successful from a tactical point of view, the campaign did achieve the group's strategic objectives, forcing Israel to increase the number of forces deployed to the area, to build additional military installations, and to spend large sums of money to supply the South Lebanese Army, SLA. Attacks on individual IDF soldiers were not designed to capture land, but were an end in themselves. They constituted the core of the group's psychological operations aimed at demoralizing the Israeli occupation forces and their SLA collaborators. These operations drove Israeli decision-makers to abandon their original vision, which focused on building up an indigenous SLA force that would police the security belt on Israel's behalf. Overall, the extended guerrilla campaign was credited with ultimately forcing Israel's unilateral withdrawal from the south. Hezbollah fighters were also strategic in identifying suitable targets, often choosing them on the basis of their political impact rather than how they would affect battlefield operations. Early attacks often targeted reservists, as opposed to regular army members, in an effort to undermine public support for the occupation. Because Israel conscripts all citizens into military service, the public response to the loss of reservists who are less seasoned than their regular counterparts was particularly acute. This eventually forced the Israeli government to change its policy to declare that only members of the regular army would be stationed in Lebanon. The close-knit character of Israeli society and its history of ransoming prisoners of war made this an especially effective strategy for Hezbollah. To this end, Hezbollah also targeted officers, as opposed to rank-and-file soldiers, and planted mines as close to the Israeli border as possible to increase the visibility of such attacks among the Israeli public. Hezbollah also took revenge on those Lebanese it accused of collaborating with Israel, often using family connections to put pressure on soldiers serving in the SLA. In addition to producing much of the high-quality intelligence that played a key role in the success of Hezbollah's military operations, it also exacerbated the SLA's already low morale. Hezbollah's ability to collect intelligence was also facilitated by the SLA's high command, which treated rank-and-file recruits, especially Shia recruits, poorly. In addition, the commitment of SLA fighters was also eroded by the popular perception that the SLA served as Israel's sandbags because SLA troops manned the frontline outposts while the Israeli soldiers operated from the better protected positions in the rear. Although Hezbollah's successful exploitation of suicide attacks contributed to the popular association of militant Islam with suicide missions, the vast majority, 81%, of suicide attacks during the Israeli occupation, 1982 to 1986, were carried out by Christians or affiliates of secular or leftist parties, and only 12 of Hezbollah's attacks involved the intentional death of a party operative. Hezbollah was credited with inspiring the use of similar attacks by other ethno-nationalist groups because its 1983 attacks precipitated the withdrawal of both French and American forces. The number of suicide attacks dropped off precipitously after the Israeli withdrawal to the security zone in 1985, and attacks on Western targets largely ended with the Civil War in 1991. These early tactics of kidnapping Westerners, initiating suicide attacks, and bombing high-profile targets were increasingly set aside as the dynamics of the conflict shifted. Subsequent attacks, largely concentrated on Israeli military targets in the south of Lebanon, and Katyusha rocket attacks on residential areas in northern Israel. Mounting losses of Israeli soldiers eroded public support for the occupation. And in 1999, Ehud Barak, who was a candidate for prime minister at the time, promised to bring the troops home if he was elected. Barak won the election, and the IDF withdrew from many of its forward military outposts. Hezbollah simultaneously ramped up the intensity of attacks, including the assassination of an SLA commander, and on the eve of Israel's May 2000 withdrawal, many of the SLA's brigades abandoned their posts and fled across the border into Israel. Others turned themselves over to Hezbollah or the Lebanese police, and many were later tried in military courts on charges of treason. From 2000 until the onset of the Israel-Lebanon War in 2006, military activities between IDF and Hezbollah forces were restricted in their intensity and were characterized mostly by tit-for-tat exchanges with few casualties. Hezbollah's military tactics were primarily rocket and mortar attacks targeting northern Israel, as well as cross-border raids and kidnappings of Israeli soldiers. The International Committee of the Red Cross was generally denied access to kidnapped soldiers, and Hezbollah party leaders routinely refused to confirm the fate of the soldiers. Israeli tactics consisted primarily of artillery fire and airstrikes in southern Lebanon. Israeli forces occasionally targeted large electrical and industrial infrastructure or waged strikes against Syrian targets, such as radar stations, inside Lebanon. In addition, the IDF allegedly assassinated several high-profile militants and Islamist spiritual leaders. During this period, and after the 2006 war, the IDF remained in control of the disputed territory known as the Sheba Farms, which lies along the border between Lebanon and Syria's occupied Golan Heights. The year 2000 also marked the beginning of the Second Palestinian Intifada uprising, which saw Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon reassert control over occupied West Bank territory that the previous Israeli government had forfeited as part of the Oslo Accords. Because the timing of the Second Intifada largely coincided with Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon, it is difficult to determine what Hezbollah's behavior after the withdrawal might have been in the absence of what many party members considered a direct provocation. Hezbollah intensified its attacks, launching daily rockets against IDF targets after Israel launched Operation Defensive Shield, its largest military incursion into the West Bank since 1967. The operation, in retaliation for suicide bombings that killed roughly 400 Israelis over the previous 18 months, Israeli countermeasures produced roughly 1,200 Palestinian casualties during the same period, trapped Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, leader Yasser Arafat in his Ramallah compound and laid siege to much of the West Bank. Despite the intensification of artillery attacks, Hezbollah stopped short of a large-scale mobilization, which Party Secretary Hassan Nasrallah claimed must be preserved for retaliation in the event that the Israeli government attempted to expel the Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza. The 2006 Lebanon War, although nominally fought between Hezbollah and Israel, extended well beyond the traditional battleground of South Lebanon. During the conflict, Hezbollah used primarily conventional tactics in the context of a war of attrition, presuming that Israeli society would not tolerate massive casualties. This strategy necessitated the maintenance of a constant barrage of rocket fire, averaging 150 to 200 rockets per day, to reinforce the perception that the Israeli campaign was ineffective at weakening the group's offensive capabilities. Hezbollah's arsenal consisted primarily of Katyusha rockets, known for their distinctive screeching noise. Because these rockets lacked a guidance system and could be outfitted with only relatively small warheads, they were most effective when launched in highly concentrated numbers. Hezbollah launched approximately 4,000 rockets into Israel during the fighting in 2006, with roughly 25% of them landing in populated areas, killing 43 civilians. To facilitate these operations, Hezbollah ensured that each unit was self-sufficient and pre-stocked with adequate supplies, making any Israeli attack on supply routes or large weapons depots irrelevant. However, this approach also resulted in the isolation of each unit, which, because of the ubiquitous Israeli air presence, prevented fighters from communicating with or supporting nearby units. To provide fortified cover and clear lines of sight, Hezbollah located bunkers and launch sites, whose size and complexity surprised even IDF intelligence, in and around villages, traditionally situated on hilltops in South Lebanon. These underground stations, which launched both short and medium-range rockets, used pneumatic lifts to bring launchers up from underground, and were often so well camouflaged that they were able to function from behind IDF lines as ground troops advanced through the south. In areas where villages or population centers were sparse, Hezbollah constructed extensive fighting positions with large and sophisticated bunker systems that included electrical wiring and ample provisions, often very close to IDF and United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, UNIFIL, positions. Hezbollah's concentration on rocket-launching sites and underground bunkers, as opposed to infantry or mobile anti-tank capabilities, suggested that the group anticipated an Israeli response composed primarily of airstrikes rather than ground attacks. Although the conventional Israeli plan for an attack in southern Lebanon focused on a ground invasion force of four army divisions, the military's chief of staff, the first Air Force general to be in that position, instead emphasized a combination of air power and special forces troops, hoping that strikes on major infrastructure targets would erode Hezbollah's support among the Christian and Sunni population. Because the sites were underground, however, Israeli pilots were unable to spot them from the air, and pilots lacked the ground intelligence necessary to pinpoint the locations of the sites. popular support for the resistance movement or insurgency. Hezbollah draws its support from the Shia community. Originating in the civil war as a militia designed to fight the Israeli occupation and to protect the Shia from both Israel and other Lebanese militias, Hezbollah has a uniquely sectarian identity. Among the Shia, Hezbollah competes with Amal for support, but also cooperates with Amal on many issues on the national stage in order to represent the Shia population. Among the other confessional groups, support has ebbed and flowed over time. After the Israeli withdrawal from the buffer zone in South Lebanon in 2000, Hezbollah was widely viewed as a national liberation force and was widely popular across sectarian divides. The withdrawal minimized conflict between Hezbollah and Israel, but some fighting did continue, albeit at a lower level. Although some thought Hezbollah's continued militancy was necessary to keep Israel in check, many within the other confessional groups in Lebanon feared that Hezbollah's activity could bring Israel back into Lebanon. In 2006, this fear became a reality, and although Hezbollah's military performance against the IDF distinguished it among some Lebanese, the group lost support among others. More recently, Hezbollah's popularity has weakened considerably since the involvement of the group in the Syrian civil war, as its assistance of the Assad government in its fight against the Sunni opposition has stoked sectarian tensions in Lebanon and dampened the ability of the group to reach across the sectarian divide and appeal to Sunnis within Lebanon.